The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Good evening. So tonight, the topic of the discussion we'll have time for questions at the end, is grief, letting go, and compassion. I will admit that I'm actually surprised at the number of people here. Because the topic of grief, that didn't sound so great, did it? Let's see if that's better. The topic of grief is not one that people are always immediately attracted to. So I'm impressed by the number of people who came. Because it's a challenging subject. But I also find that I'm going to talk about grief in many different ways, but I find that it's an integral part of the spiritual path. And that opening to it with mindfulness and compassion, leads to a lot of joy and, connection. So that's why I wanted to talk about it. I read somewhere, recently that there's people talk about high grief and low grief. And high grief is, that experience when you lose somebody who's very close to you, and a very intense experience. Low grief is kind of more, like minor losses. And recently I had a low grief experience that I think kind of demonstrates what I was saying about how, grief opens us and connects us to life. And it also shows kind of the stages that we can go through with grief. I think that often with grief, first there's resistance. We don't want to feel it. Then there's the actual experience of grief. And then there's a kind of openness or rebalancing that can come after that. And so this experience happened a couple weeks ago when I was working on this talk. I like to work on a talk and then I go for a bike ride or a walk. I exercise afterwards and it kind of turns it all and reworks it all. And so I was sitting there working on this talk, what I wanted to say, and the neighbor's cat came over. And we have a lot of bird feeders, and therefore we have a lot of chipmunks. And this is a new cat in the neighborhood. So the neighbor's cat came over and caught one of the chipmunks. And I really like chipmunks. I'm very fond of them. And I like to think of our home as a chipmunk sanctuary. And the chipmunks, I like to think of them as my friends. And don't worry, I have human friends also, but but the chipmunks are dear to me. And so I was kind of upset, and I went off on my bike ride, and I found that I was kind of churning about the experience, kind of thinking about it a lot. And at some point I realized that I was resisting what I was actually feeling. And that what I was feeling was grief. And so I connected with that and just kind of let the process kind of work its way on my heart. Let myself feel the loss of this chipmunk and the pain of that. And then after a while, I noticed that the heart kind of, it became more open and more open. And then there was this experience of kind of a compassionate connection to the poignancy of this, of life, right? Whether it's a chipmunk life or as humans. And there was a kind of fresh quality that came out of that, a fresh connection with the whole world around me, actually. And, so it's like I went through those three stages. And like I said, this is not like, I went through them very quickly, but it was a low grief experience. It wasn't like, you know, they're not my dearest friends. They're just my friends, you know. And I do kind of know some of them, particularly like in the winter. In the winter, they have like certain pathways they'll make in the snow, and they'll go back and forth, so you kind of like know which one lives where. And yeah, they're sweet. But that's what it's like. Part of life is loss, right? We lose. And we lose and we lose. And how do we connect with that? That's one of the reasons why I was saying that it's such an integral part of the spiritual path, because the core teachings of the Buddha, you know, anicca anatta dukkha, anicca, change, that everything changes. And what that means is that life includes a lot of loss, you know? And grief, I think of grief, feeling grief as part of that process of touching that truth of life and coming to terms with it, which we have to do, right? If we're going to have this open and compassionate heart, we have to come to truth with the way things are. And denying grief, though, doesn't work, right? As I was denying the grief of the chipmunk loss, it was turbulent. My mind and heart were turbulent. They wouldn't settle. In fact, as soon as I turned to the grief, then the settling started, the settling of the heart and the mind. A few weeks ago, I did an evening at my center on this topic. And a young woman in the group, I asked them, it was a smaller group than this, and I asked them why they came or what they were interested in. And one young woman, she said, "I want to know what is grief." And it was such an interesting question. And, you know, I would say that grief is the response in the heart and the mind and the body to loss. And later in the group, I don't remember exactly what we were talking about, but she had tears running down her cheeks. And I said to her, "That, I think you know what it is." She said, "I just wanted to make sure." Yeah, it's very touching. So I would say that this feeling of grief in the face of loss is just a fundamental human experience. And it's part of the process of accommodating to loss or accommodating to the truth of change, whether it's to a thing, a person, a relationship, or on a spiritual path, our treasured illusions, our treasured delusions. We can experience a lot of grief on the path as our delusions, our illusions about how life is, get worked on. We don't talk about this super amount. It's not really good advertisement for the practice. but I think sometimes it's comforting for people to know that it's a natural part of the path, because you don't want to feel isolated around that or feel like you're doing something wrong if you have that response. One Zen teacher said that practice is active participation in loss. Active participation. So real engagement with this truth of life. I also feel that grieving is an intensely spiritual activity because it blows open the heart, basically. And it blows through the illusion of permanence. So it kind of blows us open to the truth of the unrefutable fact that everything changes. Culturally, grief is kind of considered to be in bad taste, I think, culturally. It's not so acceptable. Somebody said the true religions of America are optimism and denial. And I think there's some truth to that. I think some other cultures have more kind of rituals that acknowledge grief and give it a little more space. Here we have the funeral, and then you should be done with it pretty soon. It should be cleaned up. But it feels like when I had this group the other night, what came up most often that was that what was very hard about grief for many people was the isolation, that the not having room for it somehow to be accompanied in that experience because of kind of the cultural tendency towards optimism and denial, that was what was most painful. And later we'll hear about how the Buddha dealt with that. So So we talked, I talked a little bit about mindfulness of emotion in the instructions. And so just basically with grief, when it does arise, we want to, depending on the capacity of the heart and the attention in the moment, turn towards that experience. And that even cuts the isolation if we can be there for ourselves or if the attention can be there for the experience. So what is this experience of grief? How do we feel it in the body, connecting within the body, and then connecting with it in the mind? It's interesting because it does tell some stories. It tells stories such as, I can't bear this. That's a story of grief often is, I can't bear this, or I can't bear to go on without this person or this relationship. And grief, I think, contains the secret wish that our very wishing it to not be will make it not be. Right? There's a hidden, in grief, there's a hidden hope that our resistance to that truth will make it not be true. There's a kind of protection from that. Or a belief sometimes that it shouldn't happen or it shouldn't be this way. Or that it will last forever. When grief is really strong, there can be the belief that we will never be without grief again. Actually, that's true of any emotion that's very strong. It's just wild. I think that's one of the wonders of the world or the human experience is that when we're lost in emotion, we can be so sure that it's going to last forever. Even if we can remember when grief is very strong that it's impermanent, that can be of some help because we forget that. When grief is really strong, we really forget that, right? And so just if we can remember, oh, okay, this is how it feels now, and it's not going to feel this way forever. So the very act of paying attention to grief and being with it, I think, helps or allows more the transformation, like when I was with the grief around the chipmunk. You know, that experience of turning towards it and being able to hold it helped it to move and to change and to move on. But also, sometimes it's too strong. Sometimes we need to know how to move out of it. If we're drowning in grief or overwhelming in it, then the important and helpful thing is like, how do I get out of this mind state? It's not helpful right now for me to be feeling this. There's not enough balance to be able to feel it. And, the group, it was interesting. One person said that, she looked for one beautiful thing every day that would help her when she was in grief over her husband dying. And another woman said, well, I did the same thing, she said, but I made myself document with my camera one beautiful thing every day. And it was like a way to kind of help her remember there's another world beyond grief. Help her to get some balance around it. So any time in practice that an emotion's too much for us to hold, it's helpful to know how we can move out for a period of time. Sometimes when grief's really strong, you don't even have that option, right? Then it's just like you get scoured. Your heart gets scoured and hollowed out by grief. And then it's like, how much compassion can you have for that experience happening? Compassion for the intensity. I think also grief is an interesting question for us Buddhists because there's lots of talk in Buddhism about non-attachment, right? So sometimes we get this idea, the ideal is non-attachment. And so therefore, if I'm not attached or if I can be equanimous, then I shouldn't feel grief. There's sometimes this little hidden kind of spiritual idealism there that somehow gets in. that one hurts. That one's kind of harmful, I think. That one's not so helpful. As humans, you know, this experience of being attached is very, very deep in our being. So there's different ways you can look at attachment, but the human attachment to each other, like that's how we survive. That's how as a species we evolved to survive, is through those bonds. And to try to think that Buddhism should deny that somehow seems to me unhealthy or unhelpful. They're saying it's not just humans, but like, I don't know if you can say all sentient beings, but all mammals maybe. I read the story about these elephants in a zoo in India. There were two female elephants that were housed together, and one of them died in childbirth, and the other female was inconsolable. She refused to eat or drink, and she wept, and she died of grief. So it seems to, in us mammals, right, this is such a strong thing. And the feeling of loss when a relationship ends or somebody dies, it's a real primal experience, you could say. So I sometimes think about a story that I heard related to this, a story I heard about the Buddha. I actually haven't found it in the sutras myself, but I've heard it enough that I think it's got to be somewhere. It said that when he had two chief disciples, Sariputra and Moggallanda, I don't have that name quite right, but two chief disciples, and that they died, I think, pretty near each other, and they both died before him. And it said that he said that when his chief disciples died, it was like the sun and the moon went out of the sky. What did he feel? I'm just so curious about that. Like, so in theory, the Buddha didn't experience mental suffering. That's what we hear, right? But to say the sun and the moon went out of the sky, he felt something very strong, right? Every once in a while, we get some intimation of the Buddha's life in the sutras, and I'm really curious about the transmission of the early teachings and what stories were left out or what stories were included, or you know, like that feels like a sneak story that got in or something. You know, you don't hear a lot of talk like that about the Buddha, and you can feel, not talking about masculine and feminine as archetypes, not as gender, but as archetypes, you can feel the feminine in that. And the early teachings were preserved for 500 years by male monastic communities. And I wonder how much was lost. I'm not sure about that, but I'm curious about it. Because there's stories that come out that the Buddha seems like his feminine elements come out. Like another story here about attachment and grief. Many of you know this story of Kiso Gotami in the time of the Buddha. She was a woman who she had a rough life. Most of the stories we have of the early nuns, she became a nun eventually, their lives, they were rough. And so she had a rough life. And but finally she wound up having a child, a boy. At that time, that was considered much high status. And so she was finally, things looked like they might be going her way. And then the boy died. And she lost her mind, basically. She, you know, so much grief that she lost her mind, and she wouldn't bury the child, or not bury the child, have the child cremated. That's what they did and still do pretty much. And so she was carrying the child around, trying to get somebody to save the child. And finally they sent her to the Buddha. And the Buddha was like, he came up with like the most compassionate response and a very wise response when you think about it. He said to her, I will save your child if you bring me 3 mustard seeds from a house where nobody's experienced death or death hasn't happened. And so she went around the village and she was asking at all these houses, has anybody died here? And everywhere it was like, yeah, somebody's died here. And it's such a great intervention because, first of all, it cut any sense of isolation, right, that she may have been feeling. And it gave her a chance to talk with people and to process the grief and to really come to understanding kind of the universality of this experience. And so then she was able to find peace and she went back to the Buddha and she had her child cremated and she became a nun. But you can see the wisdom and compassion in his response and how he really got her to connect with the community. And so cut that isolation and really develop understanding, both of that. So very compassionate. And what you hear in a lot of the teachings, I haven't read as much from the early monks, but I've read a lot about the early nuns, and they almost all come to practice because of great loss. Grief. It's like grief is such a, it seems to be a key motivator for a lot of people to come to practice. One thing I notice a lot in it's a very common experience that people will come to practice after a breakup, after relation breakup. And I hear it more from men than women, which is interesting. I'm not sure why, but often it's like a really difficult breakup or experience of grief will bring men and women, but I heard a lot more from men to practice. So there is a way, right, that this grief kind of breaks us open and makes us ripe for spiritual practice. It, either we really feel like we need it, right, or that the heart gets open to that experience. The nun Aya Santachita gave some teachings in our area recently, and she told the story about how when her mother died when she was 28, that's what called her to practice. So again, that experience of grief calling us to practice. So the other thing I said early on was that I'm really interested also in how grief is an integral part of the spiritual practice and the path and the transformation of the path. So many practitioners find that as they deepen in practice, that they have to transverse different landscapes of grief. And part of it is the grief of losing our treasured delusions. And part of it is just seeing more and more deeply the truth of change. Of all that arises, passes away. Sometimes we may think, oh, I came to practice for stress reduction. And this doesn't feel like that. The path does offer stress reduction, but often if we go really deep into the practice, we will go through periods that do not feel like stress reduction, that feel actually like increased stress. It's really true. Because what happens is we start to see through our cherished illusions that really protect us, the illusions that protect us, the illusions of permanence, for example, the illusions of satisfactoriness, that we will find something that's really going to do it, that there is some solution, we just haven't figured it out together, there's some solution in this mundane existence that's going to really figure everything out for me. And so we have these cherished illusions, and then the practice, as we look more and more deeply, it's like, wow, we start to see that it's a wild, wild, wild world we live in, and it's pretty uncontrollable, and there's no permanent solution. And that can disappoint us. It's like, damn, that's what I came looking for. And you're telling me like, that's not what I'm going to get. It's a kind of disillusionment process. And it can lead to grief. And yet, when we're with that, with honesty and care, kindness, equanimity grows. Equanimity, the ability to be with this world as it truly is. And that's where the rest is. That's where the rest for the heart is. And that's where the joy then can spring forth from, the joy and the real connectedness. Right? Because if we're guarding the heart from the truth, we can't really connect. But to begin to dissolve the guarding the heart from the truth, we have to be disappointed. And then we have to grieve that disappointment. And then the heart can open. In the book, I read a book, The Grace of Aging. And the author mentioned Ken McLeod, who's a Zen teacher. I mean, a Tibetan teacher. He said, at every stage of practice, there is a price to be paid for increased clarity and greater freedom. The price is the loss of another illusion. And the author continues, we grieve our way to awakening, paying our way with the release of all of our cherished and convincing fictions. Does that bum you guys out? I think it's beautiful, personally. I hope I'm not bumming you out. To me, there's something poignantly beautiful about that. We grieve our way to awakening, paying our way with the release of our cherished and convincing fictions. It's great. It's fantastic. And yet it's not kind of up there somewhere, is it? It's grounded. It's down here. So we allow the space, so the practice and the tool of mindfulness allows the heart its space to feel grief and to allow grief to transform and to transform us. And when grief runs its course, what we find is that eventually it settles. It rests, it settles into this deep compassion that's not resistant to the truth of the way things are, or that's open to the way things are. And this wide open space is a place of rest. So we see the heart goes through the denial stage of not wanting to feel, right? And then there's the grief itself, which can manifest in so many different ways. I think some of you know, a number of years ago, I wrote a talk on it started with the 13 kinds of fear that I'd experienced in practice, and the 13 got up to like 22, I think. And then I got interested in anger for a number of years, and it's like the number of kinds of anger that I experienced in practice. I got up to 24 for that one. And it was so sweet. I just taught this retiro en español. I just taught a retreat in Spanish. And I mentioned something about the 24 kinds of anger. And at the end, one guy comes up to me and when people were saying goodbye to me. And he said, my anger list is up to 39. I said, wow, that's really great. I don't know if he meant that literally, but it was pretty impressive. And then I was like, how are the kinds of grief? Like, wow, there's so many different kinds of grief. I haven't written a list. I don't know how many kinds I've experienced, but there's some. I wrote them down somewhere here. I can't remember what they are at the moment, but. Oh, I've been going through my pages differently. Oh, well, you're not going to hear them, all the different kinds, but I think some of you know There's numb, right? There's numb grief. There's violent grief. There's a hollow heart grief. There's tears, teary grief, right? Many kinds. You could say with grieving, what we allow is we allow our hearts to break. We allow our hearts to break, and that means to open. Because a broken heart is a heart that can feel and connect and respond. And that's alive. One place that I've worked some with grief is around climate change. And I think a lot of us, you can see the stages also in the response to climate change. So there's the resisting the grief, right? Or resisting the truth. And I mean, we all do that to a certain extent. It's like we're all trying to learn how to accommodate to that truth. And it doesn't happen like grieving a loss. It takes time. You kind of, with the bigger losses, you cycle through the denial, the feeling, and the openness. And you might, you know, go back and forth and go on rounds and arounds. And I see that with climate change, like, so there's the not wanting to believe it or the resisting that experience, the truth of that experience, because it's so huge, right? And, I find like I let the truth in a little at a time, right? And sometimes there's a lot of grief. I like to walk in the woods a lot, and sometimes I really open to how the environment's changing and many levels, right? There's so much, I'm not going to go into all of it, partly because it's so intense for all of us to talk about it, but there'll be that, I'll let my heart break around it. I'll let myself really feel it. And then I come out the other side, the other side of grief, which is compassion and openness and like, wow, actually we have no idea what's going to happen. Maybe as humans we'll make an evolutionary leap because of the pressure of, that's how humans have always made evolutionary leaps, is because there's been intense pressure on the species, you know. So who knows? Our openness, possibility, freshness, compassion, that's what happens when we go through the grief. So, you know, and then I'll go back into denial. And go through cycling. I think it's interesting culturally to look where we're at, too, in those stages around climate change. So mostly we're in denial, right? It's not like it was 10 years ago, but it's still mostly denial. And some people have said, and I think it's really interesting, it's like, what's going to happen when the denial, like, really starts to go? It's going to be a wild, interesting time for us humans, especially with the young people. Like, how is that response going to be? And there are probably whole different shades of grief, including anger. That's one of the shades of grief, too, is anger. What a journey we're going to take, huh? Oh, who knows how it's going to turn out? But I feel like when I can allow myself to experience that and to feel the grief, it's healing. It's healing to feel it. So grief takes us on a journey. We don't always know where the journey will go. But if we allow grief, if we allow that experience and let us take us on a journey, we grow in some way. We deepen in some way. We deepen because it forces us into the truth, a journey of truth. Grief is a journey into accommodation to the truth. And if we face grief, honestly and courageously. We see that it opens our hearts to a tender connection with all beings and a tender connection with the truth that we all share this universe of change, anicca, impermanence. I think so. We have time for questions. I'll just end with a poem that somebody shared with me recently. Did I leave that poem at home? I might have. Hold on. That's too bad. I liked it. I don't see it here. I guess I won't end with a poem. Yeah, it was very sweet. The poem is at my sister's house. Let's just sit for a minute and then there'll be time for some questions or thoughts. It's so funny that the denial stage. I'm like, if I look through one more time, I'm sure it's in here, right? But it's not. There was one other thing I wanted to say that actually didn't quite fit my talk, but it's related to the subject. So a few days ago, my father wound up in the hospital. So my father is, he's at an age and with an, you know, his health is at a place where there are kind of more and more crises. And, it's never clear which one might be, you know, the beginning of the real end of his, you know, leading to his death. And, so he's been in the hospital 3 times in the last 2 weeks and, so a few days ago when I got the call that he was in the hospital, the thought I had was, I'm so glad I've healed my relationship with him. My father and I had some bad years, a number of years where we were pretty much estranged from each other, about 10 years or so. And I really decided at a certain point that I wanted to heal that relationship and that it was important to do that. And we've done it. We've done it. And it was, that was my biggest comfort at that moment, was that we'd done that. So if there's somebody that you have a relationship that you want to heal, start early, you know. You know, it can take a long time. It took years. It took years to heal our relationship, a number of years. It's like, don't put it off, because it's a refuge when they do die that you have. You know, that things are cleaned up as best they can be. So I just wanted to share that because maybe it'll make a difference to someone or somebody out there. Yeah. I mean, that's a whole other grieving process, right? It's like when we, our own aging is a grieving process. Like the limitations that come with, I mean, I'm only 55, but I already know about some of the limitations. I know I'm only on the beginning of the end of that journey, but, you know, our own aging and, cause that's loss. That's letting go, right? And then also if we have parents, or have gone through this process with our parents of them, my father's losing certain capacities and, that's a journey, isn't it? It's a journey also. Mm-hmm. So there's time if there's questions about anything in the talk. Yes. Uh-huh.
I'll just, we have a microphone here. If you can wait. You don't have to wait long.
I'll try. First, Rebecca, your description of the utility of dissolution as part of the path, I thought was just wonderfully candid and effective. And I think it just helps someone have it sink in a little deeper. So I thank you for that. Regarding the Buddha's response to the loss of Sariputta and Moggallana, I'm wondering if we could draw an analogy to the way the Buddha would respond to physical pain. Purportedly, the Buddha had a bad back, so he had physical pain. But since he didn't shoot himself with the second arrow, he didn't have suffering the way many of us would. Well, isn't it logical that he could have psychological pain from losing his two dear friends, but he wouldn't have the psychological suffering that many of us would have? Is that a useful way to think about it, or what are your thoughts?
I do think there's something useful to that, because we can even see in our own experience that when we resist any psychological pain, that when we resist it, we suffer, and that there's a way that we can be with it that we don't, right? That when there's not the resistance, that second arrow, when it's not there, we can even see in our own way the truth of that. So it's kind of like when I had the experience with the chipmunk. You know, the suffering was actually that turbulent phase when I was resisting the truth, right? And then as I could be with the grief more and more, it lost its suffering quality. So, I think there's something. Thank you for bringing that up and thinking about it that way. Yeah, very helpful.
It's always wonderful to hear you speak, Rebecca. When you talked about your process of healing with your father, something came to me that I had never thought about before. My dad died when I was like 29, way before I had been practicing. And there's a lot of unresolved stuff from that relationship. And I'm wondering how I can bring my practice to that, even though my dad has been gone for a long time.
Great question. I think in some ways, a lot of it's the same. A lot of it's like seeing what comes up for us emotionally, allowing ourselves to feel it with mindfulness and compassion, and to allow that journey to unfold, right? So let's say there's lots of anger. So we're with the anger towards this person. If we're very honest about anger and we're mindful of it, it will transform into something else. It won't last for, it won't last forever. So maybe it transforms into hurt. Then maybe it transforms into sorrow, and then maybe that transforms into understanding. So we can, it's basically a practice of forgiveness, right? Of learning, of taking the journey through our emotions with enough honesty that eventually forgiveness arises through understanding. So what we come to understand, often what we come to understand with our parents is that that suffering basically just gets passed on through generations, and that there's no place you can place blame, you know? So we try to blame our parents, but we can't, because our parents were raised by their parents who were raised by their parents who were raised, where you can't find where any place to place the blame. That's the way you get to forgiveness. There's no place to put blame. But to get to there, you often have to be willing to feel a very deep kind of sorrow. A grief, basically a kind of grief sorrow place that, you could say accepts very deeply the imperfection of this world. So in some ways it's the same process. You know, if you can't clean it up before they die, you can clean it up afterwards. And it's worth doing because the experience of non-forgiveness binds your heart, right? your heart's wanting the release or the freedom. Is that helpful at all? Yeah. I'm just trying to think if I can say anything else about that. I know that part of my experience of forgiveness is seeing for myself how much I mess up too. There's something about really seeing how I create suffering that lets me have more space around others who create suffering. Because I don't have to make them quite so different than me. And as I can forgive myself and don't have to, you could say don't have to hate myself for the suffering that I cause, it's like a template that I can use with others that I don't have to also hate them or be angry at them. Still, we hold people responsible for their actions. I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying there. But we understand that all of us cause suffering because of our own suffering. So when you see that process within yourself, or when I see that process within myself, then I can see it within others with more ease. So that helps too. Yeah.
When you lose somebody who's very close to you, it causes you to face up to the reality that someday you will die too.
Yeah.
How do you face that anguish and that fear and that anxiety of your own eventual death?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is that if the in little bites, maybe, like if the experience, so contemplating our own impermanence in others, like knowing that we're going to die and that others that we love are going to die, usually we have to take that in really small bites because it can be too intense. Like you said, anguish, right? We can, hanging out in anguish is probably mostly not so helpful. Like to touch anguish and to know that anguish is there is helpful. But if the experience of being with it is binding us tighter, then it's helpful to move out of it, right? And so you can dip into it, but you can also know how to move out of it. It doesn't mean that you move out of knowing the truth that you will die, but it means that you know how to move out of the entanglement in emotion around it, which doesn't serve any purpose. How do you move?
Move out of it and still acknowledge it as being there.
Well, I think what you can do is you can acknowledge it, you know, briefly acknowledge that, wow, oh, that's true, and look at what it does to my heart. Oh, you know, oh, right? Then you move out of it. So you've acknowledged it. But then to move out of it is a mindfulness practice, actually. It's as important as knowing how to be with emotions is a mindfulness practice of how do I get out of emotions that aren't doing me any good. You know, they're not, because I can't be with them, really. And I mean, if you can, there might be a way that you can be with anguish, that you can actually be with it mindfully and care about yourself while you're with that experience. Then there may be some transformative power there. If you can actually care about that anguish, that may be a place to hang out that's okay. But if there's, you know, a tightening and tightening and kind of a sinking feeling, that's usually not so good. And so then the practice is, what do I need to do to get out of here? And, you know, like I said, my students, say one of them, you know, would go out with her camera and walk and take pictures of beautiful things. Like that helped her to get out of it. It's like we learn how are different ways of getting out of it. Somebody might call somebody. For me, sometimes when I'm in emotional states that I find not so useful, I'll clean the house. That works really well for me, and you get a clean house, you know. It's an extra bonus in there, so, you know. So it's part of the practice is knowing for yourself what, how to really take care of this human heart, body, and mind. Yeah. Does that helpful?
Yeah. It's something you have to keep repeating to yourself all the time because the tendency is to get hung up on it and not move out of it. So, and I think it helps to come in here and talk about these things. And I have more questions, but I won't ask them.
There's a lot I could say on that. I just taught a 5-week class at our meditation center about intimacy with life and death was the title of the class. And it was for older folks, for seniors from 55 on. I just made the cut.
One thing I've done is I've wanted to talk to young people who've been soldiers in the war because they have to face death all the time, whereas most young people in our culture don't have to. But I think if you're in a war like Iraq or Afghanistan, it's always there.
That's a great idea. Yeah. So finding some way that you can visit the subject that feels that there's some balance and growth and transformation within it for yourself and not a sinking into unhelpful mind states. Yeah. So that's a great idea, what you just said. Because there's connectedness with that too, and it sounds like connectedness helps you to absorb that truth. That when you can connect with others around it, it helps you to bring in that truth in a way that feels more balanced, is what I'm hearing you say. Yeah, so you're finding your own little way there.
But what I'm afraid of is when it comes time to die, I won't have accumulated all the wisdom that I need.
The Buddhists say you'll get another lifetime, so you get another chance. But there's also like one thing that you can just do is just like at the end of each breath, let go. You know, like that's a practice of dying. You know, so there's little ways that you can like, it's all about learning to let go because death is the great letting go. Basically, that's what it is. You know, like letting go of everything, right? Letting go. That's what you don't want to resist at the end, right? Is the letting go. So it's like there's so much practice in letting go in life. So how do we let go? How do we let go? How do we go flow gracefully with the fact that everything's moving, you know? So there's like that level we can practice at without even, you know, having to name that death, right? But basically, active participation in loss, that's what practice is. And loss, it's just another word for death. Yeah. Yeah, we could talk a long time about that.
Okay, I'll just say one final thing. There was a young man who was a soldier in Iraq, and all the bullets were flying around him, and he saw his fellow comrades being killed and all that. And he said that when you're in that situation, you don't think about being rich, you don't think about being famous, you just think about taking that next breath.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah. One time I was having surgery, and so I got the anesthesia, right? And I could taste the anesthesia. I tasted it like I think it was in the back of my throat, right? And after I tasted the anesthesia, my next thought was, I could die. My next thought was, what do I want my last thought to be? And my next thought was metta. And two mettas, and then I went out, you know, into the anesthesia. It was like practice. It was really interesting. And you know how fast that is between tasting the anesthesia and being out. So that I made it slow, but it was like, I can't say it as fast as it happened, but it was like, I could die. What's my next thought? What do I want my last thought to be? Metta, metta. And you can practice. Maybe that's a good place to end. It's a couple minutes before 9. I think somebody has some announcements to take. Tom, come on up.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.